Hi, this is The Takeaway on an extremely busy Wednesday, January 11th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Only in America, folks, a study in contrasts. Obama's elegiac goodbye last night and Donald Trump's reminder at a news conference in New York today that he has no problem just winging it. It was President-elect Donald Trump's first news conference since winning the election in November.
Thank you very much. It's very familiar territory, news conferences, because we used to give them on a almost daily basis. I think we probably maybe won the nomination because of news conferences.
The president-elect took questions and addressed a series of topics in no particular order, from job creation.
I will be the greatest jobs producer that God ever created, and I mean that. I'm going to work very hard on that.
He talked about the inauguration coming up.
The 20th is going to be something that will be very, very special, very beautiful.
Veterans came up. The whole problem with veterans, he said, is going to be fixed with help from the top hospitals in the country. No details. Then he turned the microphone over to attorney Sherry A. Dillon, who laid out how Trump would separate himself from his business interests while he's in the White House. But the topic Trump couldn't get away from was his relationship with Russia.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get along with Vladimir Putin. I hope I do, but there's a good chance I won't. And if I don't, do you honestly believe that Hillary would be tougher on Putin than me? Does anybody in this room really believe that? Give me a break.
Someone should tell Donald Trump that Hillary Clinton actually lost the election. The press conferences, though, come today after a blistering report that was released yesterday by CNN and then later with more unverified information from BuzzFeed. And that dominated the conversation today. In the report, CNN learned that the chiefs of America's intelligence agencies briefed President Obama, President-elect Trump, and members of Congress last week about unsubstantiated reports that Russia has collected compromising information of a personal nature and other allegations as well about the future president. Sean Spicer, a spokesman for the president-elect, addressed that story at the news conference today head-on before Trump even took to the podium.
It's frankly outrageous and highly irresponsible for a left-wing blog that was openly hostile to the president-elect's campaign to drop highly salacious and flat-out false information on the internet just days before he takes the oath of office.
No news organization has been able to verify the details of the report, and the story may not survive the news cycle. But Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us. Hi, Todd. Where does this stand right now?
Well, something important happened at the top of the news conference on the CNN and BuzzFeed reports that you were just referring to. Trump spokesman Sean Spicer did a similar thing to what Donald Trump did, and I think it's really important. I want to point it out. Donald Trump referred to one news organization, presumably BuzzFeed, and one television channel, presumably CNN, that had run this information about him that he called phony stuff. It didn't happen. He called it disgraceful. He's conflating those two things, and they're a world apart journalistically and in terms of what was reported. BuzzFeed blasted on the internet the entire 35-page dossier from a former British intelligence official, according to reports, that's been passed around Washington detailing what is believed in those reports to be information that the Russians have on Donald Trump of a personal nature that would be compromising. We're not talking about those details because they are unsubstantiated. CNN didn't report any of that. CNN reported that intelligence officials briefed Donald Trump, briefed the president, and briefed eight members of Congress cleared to get highly classified intelligence information, that this potentially compromising information that the Russians claimed it was in their hands. Those are two very separate things. Donald Trump and Sean Spicer conflated both of those things. One, that the information is true or is out there, BuzzFeed, don't know, unsubstantiated, or CNN, that Donald Trump was briefed on it. Donald Trump was asked if he was briefed on that information, and he said he wouldn't talk about those briefings.
But we had many witnesses in that meeting, many of them with us. And I will say again, I think it's a disgrace that information would be let out.
What else happened at the news conference?
there was a great deal of back and forth, at least some, on the allegations from Russia. And I want to point out one other thing that's important that people might not be aware of. Other reports in The Guardian reported this morning a couple of things. One is that the dossier in question, again unsubstantiated, was passed by Senator John McCain to the FBI back in December. John McCain has confirmed that he passed the dossier in question to the FBI. FBI Director James Comey has been asked about it, said that he won't discuss any FBI ongoing investigations about whether there was regular contact between the Trump campaign and representatives of the Kremlin throughout the presidential election. But also a report in The Guardian that the FBI applied to the FISA court, John, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that I know you're very familiar with, to get warrants on four Trump staffers back in the summer because of suspicion that they may be having improper or irregular contact with Russian agents or Russian actors during the campaign. According to The Guardian, that initial request for warrants was denied. It was then narrowed, and then a warrant was granted. But we don't know what the FBI did with that warrant, who they listened to, or what they did with the information. James Comey, again, not answering questions about what he said might be an ongoing investigation.
All right. The discussion and Trump volunteered information about his enthusiasm for solving the problem with veterans in the United States. He also talked about how he's going to be the best job creator in the universe. I mentioned that at the top. But there were no details, really, about his economic program. What was he really forthcoming about? ACA, the Affordable Care Act.
A little bit on the ACA, saying that repeal and replace on Obamacare, as he says, are going to happen simultaneously. Members of Congress wanted to have a plan where they repeal Obamacare right away and then have a delay so that 20 million or so people who have benefits either through Medicaid or the exchanges now don't lose them abruptly. They said, well, we'll phase out the benefits over 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. Mitch McConnell now, it appears, does not have the votes for a plan like that. So Donald Trump seems to be catching the wind in Congress here that repeal and replace have to happen together. That's where the votes seem to be. But not a lot of detail beyond that. He's going to have a fabulous plan. He's going to have the best health care. Did not answer the key question, how many people would be covered? Would each of the 20 million people who have coverage now still have coverage in a new plan? He didn't answer that. John, he was pretty forthcoming. His lawyer was pretty forthcoming on the issue of conflicts of interest and ethics.
President-elect Trump's investments in business assets, commonly known as the Trump Organization, comprising hundreds of entities, which again, if you all go and take a look at his financial disclosure statement, the pages and pages and pages of entities have all been or will be conveyed to a trust prior to January 20th.
Let's talk about the visuals. I mean, here he is surrounded by flags. There's this table stacked with dossiers and folders. And then there's this lawyer who's brought in to explain how Donald Trump is going to actually separate himself from his businesses. She talks for a while, and then he actually addresses the question of what's going to happen to his businesses.
I have a no conflict of interest provision as president. It was many, many years old. This is for presidents because they don't want presidents getting I understand. They don't want presidents getting tangled up in minutia. They want a president to run the country. So I could actually run my business. I could actually run my business and run government at the same time. I don't like the way that looks, but I would be able to do that if I wanted to. I'd be the only one that would be able to do that. You can't do that in any other capacity. But as a president, I could run the Trump Organization, great, great company, and I could run the company, the country. I'd do a very good job, but I don't want to do that.
Now, is that supposed to be reassuring?
Donald Trump says he could do it. He is correct that there's really no law that prevents him from running the Trump Organization and being president. But what's legal is not ethical necessarily. And the issue here is the ethical imperative of a conflict of interest, whether Donald Trump has two sets of interests, his personal financial interest and his interest in representing the country as president. Two different things. So a couple of things. One, spinning off full control, Donald Trump says, of the Trump Organization, full management to sons Eric and Don Jr. Won't discuss under the rules of this arrangement any business dealings with his sons whatsoever. They won't discuss it with him. Any business dealings that the Trump Organization makes domestically will have to have sign off from a special ethics counselor who will be appointed to the board of the Trump Organization. And Donald Trump's not allowed to know about any of it. All of Donald Donald Trump's Trump Organization holdings will be conveyed to a trust, which he will have no control over, and all management will go to his kids and to another Trump Organization executive called Alan Weisberg. Now, the foreign parts of Donald Trump's holdings are quite another issue. There are restrictions in the Constitution about any president taking foreign payments from any foreign government, king or prince. Sherry Dillon, Donald Trump's lawyer, went and made a legal argument. She said that profits from a hotel or a business don't qualify under the Emoluments Clause ban on foreign payments. That's never been tested in court. So this is her legal argument, saying if Donald Trump got profits from, you know, somebody paying their hotel bill, even if it was an overseas foreign interest, that would be fine under the law. Donald Trump, however, can't unknow which hotels, which interests, and which branding deals he has around the world. That's impossible. He can't unknow where his interests are. Sherry Dillon said that no new foreign deals will be made at all. The Trump Organization will not be making any new foreign deals. Existing deals remain in place, of course, which, as I said, Donald Trump can't unknow. And went one step further, Sherry Dillon said, just as an added precaution, even though he doesn't have to do it, Donald Trump will donate any profits from his foreign interests to the U.S. Treasury.
And so is this enforceable? I mean, Todd, can you really enforce no conversations about the Trump Organization with his sons? That just seems utterly unworkable.
Stipulating that I'm not a lawyer, as you and all takeaway listeners know, what I do know is that this is a voluntary agreement that has been reached between Donald Trump, his sons, his children, Ivanka, and the lawyers. Completely voluntary. There are no cops for this kind of thing, relying on self-enforcement and on a strong sense of propriety and ethics, John.
The contrasts of last night and today. Just a word about that.
I don't think any fair observer could have watched those two appearances and seen a sharper contrast between tone, style, imperative, and intention between President Obama and Donald Trump. Donald Trump now has the opportunity to write his own chapter for his presidency, starting off with this news conference today. He takes the oath of office in just a little over a week, John.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
Chairman Corker, Ranking Member Cardin, and members of the committee, it is an honor to appear before you today as President-elect Trump's nominee for Secretary of State.
Former ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson wants to be Secretary of State, but at his confirmation hearing before the Senate today, he faced questioning by people who weren't treating him like a CEO. Here he is asked about Russia by Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio.
Is Vladimir Putin a war criminal?
I would not use that term.
Well, let me describe the situation in Aleppo, and perhaps that will help you reach that conclusion. In Aleppo, Mr. Putin has directed his military to conduct a devastating campaign. He's targeted schools, markets, not just assisted the Syrians in doing it. His military has targeted schools and markets and other civilian infrastructure. It's resulted in the death of thousands of civilians. This is not the first time Mr. Putin is involved in campaigns of this kind.
In his 10 years at the top of Exxon, Rex Tillerson negotiated oil and gas rights in 22 countries. Does that experience make him good at designing a policy that's good for the oil industry or good for expanding American values of justice and human rights around the world? He referenced that in his opening statement. Suzanne Maloney is a former Middle East advisor for ExxonMobil and currently the deputy director of the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. Hey, Suzanne, how do you evaluate all this?
Well, I think he's an unconventional pick for Secretary of State. But I think he also has at least the potential to be an interesting and potentially innovative leader for American foreign policy. He has been in a position where he's been forced to have a very global view, a very long-term view, and to deal with issues around the world in a way that has very much day-to-day operational on-the-ground relevance. So this is someone who hasn't been sitting in an ivory tower. He hasn't been part of the political process here in Washington on a day-to-day basis. But he does deal with the realities of the world in which U.S. power is going to be confronted over the course of the next 4 years.
Do you think that his view is what's good for business is good for American foreign policy? Or would he separate those and have a bigger idea in terms of a vision?
Well, he's got to separate those. I think this is the challenge that Tillerson will have in transitioning roles. And it's not a challenge that's unique to him. Every cabinet officer who comes from a different walk of life, whether it's Congressman Pompeo, who's moving from a position of elective politics to one of leading the intelligence community, General Mattis, who's moving from a kind of position of having been a combatant commander to leading the massive bureaucracy that is the Pentagon, Tillerson is going to have to shift his lens from one in which his day-to-day responsibility, his fiduciary responsibility as CEO of a major oil and gas company, was to ask what is good for my business, to one that looks at the challenges and opportunities around the world and asks what is good for American interests in this environment. And I believe he can make that leap. I'm confident he can make that transition because, in effect, he has had the experience of leading a large organization in which American foreign policy is very relevant.
He has a longstanding relationship with Vladimir Putin and a focus on Russia in his career.
Well, Russia, more than anything, wants to reestablish its role in the global world order. They have a view that following the breakup of the Soviet Union, they were mistreated in some respects in the transition period. They believe they deserve a rightful role in the global world order because they are a nuclear power.
He's already talked, though, in terms of a policy that would create a kind of coexistence, a detente almost, in the 21st century. That's an extraordinary reversal. Do you see that happening under his tenure?
Well, I think, you know, it's going to be a very interesting hearing today. I expect Russia to be at the top of the agenda even before some of the revelations that were dominating the press over the course of the past 24 hours. There have been a lot of concerns among both Republicans and Democrats on the Hill and elsewhere in Washington about Tillerson's longstanding experience in doing business with Russia and his personal relationship with Vladimir Putin. I think it's very important that that is dealt with in great depth today. From what I understand and from what I know from my own experience, I believe that Tillerson's direct day-to-day on-the-ground experience in doing business in a place like Russia gives him a fairly realistic understanding, not just of the opportunities for creating a better relationship with Russia, but also of the challenges and threats and tremendous vulnerability that the world faces from a resurgent Russia. And in fact, his statement makes reference to that. It talks about the invasion of Ukraine, the taking of Crimea, the genuine sense of fear and legitimate sense of fear that our NATO allies have as a result of Russia's actions around the world. And so I don't think we're going to see a Secretary of State, if Mr. Tillerson is confirmed, who's liable to be soft on Russia. He's got a very sort of hard-nosed understanding of what Russian interests and Russian power are. He does seem to believe, and certainly Trump seems to believe, that there is a possibility of fashioning a newfound cooperation between Washington and Moscow. How that plays out in practice, I think, will prove much more difficult in reality than it did on the campaign trail.
A lot of people look at the $500 billion deal in the Arctic between Russia and Exxon, which is held up by sanctions, as a complete deal breaker in terms of him being credible in this position. How do you view it?
Well, the sanctions issue is one I think he'll be questioned on in great detail today. And it's important that he makes clear that he's speaking for the American people, no longer for a major American corporation.
Do you think someone like Tillerson could open North Korea, could be a leader?
Well, that's going to be one of his primary challenges, dealing with the threat that's posed by a nuclear-armed North Korea. So I think he's going to be confronted with that, with Venezuela, with a number of other issues that he probably hasn't been focused on, at least over the course of the past few months in his early days, if he's confirmed.
Suzanne Maloney is former Middle East advisor for ExxonMobil and currently the deputy director of the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much, Suzanne.
Thank you.
22-year-old Charleston, South Carolina church shooter Dylan Roof was sentenced to death for the hate crime murder of 9 African-American churchgoers that shocked the nation nearly 2 years ago. The jury of 9 white and 3 blacks, who last month found him guilty of 33 counts, reached a unanimous verdict within about 3 hours. Meg Kennard is political and legal affairs reporter for the Associated Press based in South Carolina. She's been covering the shooting and the trial for nearly 2 years now. It's felt at times like a mechanical process, but she says The emotional tension has been there in court since the first drop of the gavel.
Dylann Roof acknowledged in his very brief closing arguments he could have asked the jury to spare his life and didn't. In fact, he said that he didn't think that even really make much of a difference. He did make a closing argument. He took the opportunity to say his piece to the jury, but it wasn't a pleading. It wasn't, you know, please don't sentence me to death for this. I mean, there was none of that. If anything, his strongest statement that he made was that he'd do it all over again because he feels like he had to. I'm not on that jury. I wasn't privy to their discussions, but hearing that directly from the man whose fate they're weighing likely played a pretty big role in their discussions. Having watched this trial unfold over these past few weeks, to hear a defendant go in front of the jury and say, you know I could ask you guys to not to execute me, but I'm not going to. I can't imagine being a jury hearing that and then going back to deliberate and spending a whole lot of time talking about anything but a death sentence.
Given what you just said, that Dylann Roof in his statement indicated he would do it all again, I guess he didn't address the victims in any direct way.
No, he didn't. They certainly were paying close attention to what he said, but he expressed no regret. A lot of attention during the guilt phase of trial and also particularly during sentencing focused on a jailhouse journal that Roof kept that was found in his cell at the Charleston County Jail about 6 weeks after he was arrested. That journal contained a lot of the same information from his online manifesto, thoughts about the races, thoughts about white supremacy. In those writings, he also said that he wanted to make one thing crystal clear, that he had not shed a single tear for the families of any of the people that he killed. You know, hearing that kind of information and those kinds of words coming directly from the person after the fact, at a time where a lot of defendants would express remorse, maybe, or have second thoughts, he wanted to make it clear and double down in a way on what he had done. And that's hard to ignore, I guess, when you're a jury considering these very serious cases.
Dylann Roof made a motion right after the sentencing or the announcement of the sentence from the jury. What did that mean, do you think?
It's hard to say. Far be it from me to prognosticate. This case has been full of surprises. But Dylann Roof did ask the judge if he could have a new legal team to then for him make a motion for a new trial. I believe Dylann Roof has, by statute, 90 days to file an appeal in this case. And the judge said that, you know, he was very reluctant to appoint a new legal team to handle what Roof was asking. But if he does file an appeal, there will be a different appellate set of lawyers who specialize in those kinds of things and will be dealing with that. But Judge Richard Gergel, the judge who's presided over these entire proceedings, appointed Roof's current counsel, the ones that Roof fired when he went into the sentencing phase so he could represent himself. And so the judge said that he was reluctant to do that. In terms of what it means for Dylann Roof, I'm not exactly sure. You know, he got rid of his lawyers. He said he wanted to do this in his own voice and represent himself. The fact now that he wants new lawyers, I think maybe he's realized that there are just a lot of legal ins and outs that if you have no legal training, and particularly for a case of this magnitude, it can be pretty difficult to try to learn on the fly.
You know, there's a mechanical quality to this trial, it seems, and you've described it here. I'm wondering if, just looking at the whole proceeding, has it underscored the pain that the victim's community is still suffering and suffered at the time of this crime? And in any sense, do you get a feeling that Dylann Roof represents a constituency in the community of South Carolina, or is he a lone wolf?
I think that to say that, you know, this was a painful circumstance for South Carolina, you're absolutely right. I was in Charleston the night of the shootings. I knew Clemente Pinckney from covering the state legislature. And it seems that just about everybody you talked to had some sort of connection. Certainly Charleston is a place that a lot of people love both to visit and to live there. And I can't imagine that Dylann Roof is representative of a lot of people here in the severity of his beliefs. You know, clearly he said he'd read things online and he'd watched certain movies about white supremacy, but this is obviously taken to an extreme. The planning and all of the thought process that went into targeting this specific church. There's no evidence he communicated with anybody about his plans or anything of that nature. So it does seem like it was a singular situation, but this process has moved through, I think, on the quicker side of things for a case this involving 33 separate counts. And that's just a heck of a lot. And, you know, I think that people in Charleston particularly are looking toward this as perhaps the first stage of closure. The state is still pursuing its own case, which, as I mentioned, is separate. But all of these shootings and the graphic nature and the fact that this happened at a church in the middle of a city that so many people love, that ripped a major wound in a lot of people.
Well, I can hear the toll that it's taken on you, but incredible work. Meg, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Meg Kennard is political and legal affairs reporter for the Associated Press, based in South Carolina. A federal law passed in the 1970s requires that public schools provide adequate education to children with special needs. The problem, however, is that the bar for what adequate education is varies with each community, each family, each disability, and each school district. Today, the Supreme Court hears arguments in Andrew v. Douglas County School District that involves a Colorado couple who withdrew their autistic son from public school, saying from their perspective, the bar for adequate was far too low. Can the Supreme Court clarify this requirement for the estimated 5.7% of school-aged children who have been identified as having specific learning disabilities? Wayne Steedman is a senior partner with the Steedman Law Group and works on special education law. He says the last time the Supreme Court considered the appropriate level of educational benefit for children with disabilities was 1982 in a case known as Rowley.
The reason it's coming back to the court today is that the law has been amended multiple times since the Rowley case in 1982. And each time Congress has amended the law, they have increased more of a burden, if you will, on the school system, raising the bar higher in terms of what is required for a child to be receiving an appropriate education. But at no time did Congress ever say, well, we're overruling Rowley and establishing a new standard. And when Congress does that, when they make it that clear, then it's easy for the courts. But since they never did that, then the courts are still struggling with what does this sum educational benefit actually mean? And each court throughout the country, various courts, look at it and say, well, you know, this is what we think it means, and they don't all think it means the same thing.
To be clear, there's no constitutional issue here. It's just the lack of clarity in the law that governs special education for people with disabilities.
That would be correct, yes.
Now, would the court under any circumstances come up with a standard? I mean, disabled children are so varied and their needs are so completely diverse. I'm at a loss to imagine any kind of standard that would work here.
Yeah, it's not going to be specific. They're not going to say that, well, each and every child has to achieve at X level. So it's going to have to be something along the lines of perhaps saying that children with disabilities must meet certain requirements of the Act. And the Act does spell out a number of requirements, such as narrowing the gap between children with disabilities and children without disabilities. Mm. It talks about ensuring that children move towards developing skills that will allow them to be independent, employment, as well as further future education. So those are the stated purposes of the Act. And you know, when you look at it that way, you have to say that trivial, minimal benefit certainly is going to accomplish that.
In the tone of the Act, in the kind of reason the Act exists, do the schools play a role of enthusiastically wanting to incorporate special education into their curriculum, or is this a burden that they view as something that they'll do the minimum of, and it has nothing to do with their primary mission?
Well, I think that that's going to vary from school district to school district, and we've got a lot of school districts in the country. And I've certainly encountered school districts that are enthusiastically embracing the idea of helping a child with a significant disability make progress and try and help that child develop the skills that they need to move on for independence and employment or further education. And then you have some school districts who do see it as a burden and see it as an expense, an unfunded mandate, if you will, although there is funding for the IDEA by the federal government, but the funding has never been at the level that Congress promised when they first enacted the law in 1975. So the states feel like they've been, kind of placed with this burden of fulfilling this law without ever having gotten the funding that they were promised to do it. So, it's going to vary from school district to school district. Some are going to say, yeah, it's a burden, and others are going to say that, yes, this is our child. This is one of our children. This child has the right to an appropriate education to the same extent as any other child, and we're going to do our best for every single child.
Wayne Steedman is senior partner with the Steedman Law Group. He has 2 decades of experience representing children and parents with disabilities in the special education system. Thank you so much, Wayne.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Over the course of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the role of the Navy SEALs has bloomed into American consciousness. The once secret special operations units are now celebrated as this country's ultimate weapon and an exemplary demonstration of valor. Last night, the president mentioned the SEALs' most famous operation, getting Osama bin Laden.
Our law enforcement agencies are more effective and vigilant than ever. We have taken out tens of thousands of terrorists, including bin Laden.
The mythology of the SEALs has been celebrated in Hollywood movies, where they are portrayed as the bravest, the toughest. But for all the honor and valor of the SEAL reputation, the reality of the SEAL team actions may be something less than heroic. A 2.5-year investigation by Matthew Cole of The Intercept tells a very different story. The 5-part article out this week shows how instead of precision kills, there are often unnecessary casualties and brutal mutilations and a violence tolerated seemingly without accountability. Matthew Cole is an investigative journalist for The Intercept.
There are always rules, laws, and rules of engagement in any battle zone. By and large, the SEALs generally abide by them overall. The real issue is that when you get into special operations, you get into sort of the elite cadre, you start to get into really gray areas. So the SEALs or SEAL Team 6 have a thing, unjustified shootings, which is someone ends up dead who wasn't armed, and they have to justify it. But it's precisely because they're so good that where there were initially aberrations and became something like a persistent virus, as a few former SEAL Team 6 leaders referred or compared it to with me, they were clear violations of rules of engagement, of ethics, battlefield ethics, of morality. It is highly unlikely for a member of SEAL Team 6 to ever be prosecuted for mutilating a dead body. And that still doesn't make it okay. Moreover, one of the saddest things that I found during this investigation was that I had, and frankly the motivation for people who were willing to talk, was they felt that the command, and they included themselves, had betrayed the younger SEALs by not giving them a bright red line that they weren't supposed to cross. And we are starting to see, and I mentioned at least one example in my story of someone who is really suffering because of several, at least one, but several incidents that he was a part of in Afghanistan.
Let's listen to the account of Britt Slavinsky, who's a member of SEAL Team 6, who's won the Navy Cross, but he speaks in a tone that I think suggests some of the things that you've uncovered in your investigation. Listen.
My God, just a phenomenal, phenomenal day.
Just a good trap.
It was, and we just slaughtered those dudes. Talk about funny stuff that we did. After I shot this dude in the head, there was a guy that had his feet sticking out of some little rut or something over here. He was dead, but people got nervous. I shot him about 20 times in the legs, and every time you kick him or shoot him, he would kip up, and you could see his body twitch and all that. And it was like a game, look at this dude. And the guy was just,
twitch again.
It was good therapy.
Yeah, I'll bet.
It was really good therapy for everybody that was there.
Who is Britt Slavinsky?
Britt Slavinsky is a legendary member of SEAL Team 6 who was the team leader during the Operation Anaconda mission in 2002, March 2002, where the first member of SEAL Team 6 died. Neil Roberts fell out of the back of a helicopter during an attempt to land on a 10,000-foot mountaintop to establish an observation post. And he led the sniper team to try to recover Roberts, which ultimately failed. And he won a Navy Cross for his heroism and his valor that day. But for him and for others at SEAL Team 6, and especially for their subunit, which was Red Team, they were really, really shaken up by the death of Roberts. Neil Roberts fell out of a helicopter at about 10 feet, was killed fairly quickly after that by Al-Qaeda fighters, was shot in the head. But when the SEALs found his body, when they recovered his body, they found that the Al-Qaeda fighters had tried to cut his head off. And it really, really shook up SEALs.
And so that's what Slavinsky is referring to when he says it was really good therapy to do this mutilation.
Yes, the operation that he's referring to on the tape happens about a week later. They found that the Al-Qaeda fighters that they killed, there were about 20 that day, had been up on the mountaintop or had come up on the mountaintop later because they had American gear that had been left behind. He refers to it as, you know, the thing that I found most interesting, and it was not just the tone of his voice, but the way he describes it as therapy. It was therapeutic. When I unearthed this audio, I gave the transcript to two former superiors of Britt Slavinsky and said, this is what I found, this is what he said. And they both were horrified. And one of them said, one said they would have fired him instantly if they had known he had said it. But the other one said something, and again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier. Because he became such a senior figure at the command and was so influential, that undoubtedly there were young SEALs who were influenced by that bravado.
And could see he was untouchable.
And could see that he was untouchable. And so 5 years later, Slavinsky is involved in a very senior position in Afghanistan in 2007, making a remark to his men that he wanted a head on a platter. And one of his operators, one of his SEAL operators, interpreted that as a order. And so on an operation, after they had killed some Taliban fighters, he attempted to cut the head off of one of the fighters and had gotten pretty far before he was stopped. And that's one of the stories in the piece that we published. But what it gets at is it wasn't just the command culture and climate that had allowed for Slavinsky to become so influential. But none of the officers who have the commission by law for law and order, for good order and discipline, none of the officers at SEAL Team 6 who were a part of the cover-up or who were aware of what had really gone on in Afghanistan and Iraq, none of them were ever reprimanded. There was no accountability. And to this day, they are now, you know, high risers inside the special operations community. One is the top SEAL in America, runs all SEALs. To be honest with you, that's what the story is really about. It's the total failure of leadership at SEAL Team 6. And it's been a problem for a long time. And they have refused to address it.
An ugly, dark side to the legendary SEAL Team 6 and special operations in the U.S. military. Matthew Cole is an investigative journalist for The Intercept. Great work, Matthew. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
President Barack Obama gave his final speech as commander-in-chief in Chicago yesterday. His message, don't just sit around, folks.
If something needs fixing, then lace up your shoes and do some organizing. If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself. Show up. Dive in. Stay at it.
President 44 and out. In a classy, confident, and emotional farewell speech, President Barack Obama expressed his love for the people closest to him, like his wife, Michelle.
You made the White House a place that belongs to everybody. And the new generation sets its sights higher because it has you as a role model. So you have made me proud, and you have made the country proud.
The president stood in a packed hall at Chicago's McCormick Place, acknowledging unfinished business and listing accomplishments. He also warned that longstanding tensions in American society remain potent despite progress and must be addressed honestly and directly in the coming years.
But we're not where we need to be. And all of us have more work to do. If every economic issue is framed as a struggle between a hardworking white middle class and an undeserving minority, then workers of all shades are going to be left fighting for scraps while the wealthy withdraw further into their private enclaves.
You can hear the support there in Chicago, but in the community where Barack Obama began his political life, there are people who feel as though he missed a chance to show leadership. We go to one of them now, Jamal Green, a 21-year-old community organizer and activist who watched the president's speech last night and says that in quality of life and especially in the out-of-control gun violence in that city, he feels left behind by a man he had great hopes for.
I was a big supporter of the president coming up. I was in elementary school before he was president, and I was reciting his speeches. I think that once he got in office, he did somewhat forget about the people at the bottom.
What do you think is the cause of the violence that has spiked in Chicago, and what do you think the president could have done about it?
When you look at the violence, you got to look at the root problems. Policing is not a root problem because they're just there to react. You got to look at the lack of investment into urban communities. You know, here in Chicago, we get under 20% of city resources to go to black communities. And so when you talk about that, you talk about the underfunded schools. We have 50 schools that are boarded up just sitting in our neighborhoods, lowering the property value. You're talking about the lack of economic development in our neighborhoods. You talk about people walking around with so much trauma, with so many problems because they see people dying and they don't have any hope. They don't have any parents, and you don't have mental health clinics to help people with mental health issues. The unemployment rate is the highest in Chicago than it is around the country amongst black youth. So, you know, we have to work on that. Give people jobs. We got to give people housing. We got to develop in the urban communities, and we got to have a level playing field.
You're 21 years old, right?
Yes.
You're a community organizer. You are probably walking in exactly the same footsteps as Barack Obama did in his 20s, as he talked about last night in his speech, right?
Yes. Yeah.
What do you think he would see if he was your colleague and not leaving office as president of the United States? What do you think he would see as the priorities right now?
You know what? I think when he was here, he kind of saw the same things that I'm saying today. Walking in these communities, grassroots, and talking to people about the problems in the neighborhoods, you know, he would see the poverty. He would see how the urban communities are neglected, and he would see these families that I visit in a hospital every single day because they're affected by gun violence, and nobody's doing anything about it. You know, gun violence is so normal that not an alderman, not a mayor, not a leader is saying anything or doing anything about the gun violence. You know, all they're doing is reacting to the families, and police are there to react, and they're not solving any of these murders. So it's continuing. So he would see these problems that are plaguing the communities every single day and you know, try to fix them, you know. But I think once he got in power, in that position of power, you know, he kind of lost sight a little bit and forgot about the people at the bottom. And that's where it starts.
Do you worry that in the way that you're talking now to me and in, you know, expressing these views, particularly now as President Obama leaves office, that you're maybe unwittingly endorsing Donald Trump's view of where blacks live in urban America, in hell, in terrible communities, dismiss them as just, you know, unlivable places of madness?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's true. Honestly,
you think Trump's right?
Donald Trump is actually correct in that. I do not like Donald Trump at all. I was very one of the main people responsible for shutting down his rally here in Chicago. And, you know, Donald Trump is not the type of person that I believe should be president. But he used the truth against Hillary Clinton. And that is the truth. Black people are living in hell. Black people are living in basically cages. USA, they push us into these communities with no resources, no funding. They're food deserts. So, you know, you got these people basically living in third world countries in a city that you can go downtown and it's Disney World. So, you know, it's true. We're living in these communities are hell. And he used that to his advantage. But I'm definitely not a supporter of his.
Is it, you know, Barack Obama said last night, all right, if you're complaining about things, if you're worried about things, lace up your shoes and get involved. Do you think your level of involvement is enough? Do you think this problem is something that can be taken care of at the local level? Just forget the federal government for the next 4 years.
I do, actually. I think that, you know, we can't depend on a president. Black people have survived through a Reagan. Bush won, stupid Bush two, Bill Clinton's prison policies, and then, you know, even being a little ignored by Barack Obama. And so we know that the national level won't have an effect on us, but it definitely starts locally. It starts with our mayors. It starts with our aldermen. You know, it starts with our congressmen, our state reps. The president won't trickle down right here to these communities. It starts with our leaders that's right here. And so we see that when we go and protest Rahm Emanuel's house and say, Rahm, you know, give these police officers tasers. And then the next day he says, okay, every officer is going to have a taser. Rahm, give these officers body cameras. Okay, the next day he gives officers body cameras. We see that change can be affected right here, policies and with the legislators. We just have to get out there and hold them accountable for what they're supposed to do.
Jamal Green, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All Politics is Local in Chicago, says Jamal Green, a community organizer and activist and critic of Barack Obama in Chicago. What's your departing message for President Obama? Full Moon Muse tweets, I'd like to thank POTUS and family for their work and efforts despite the partisan pushback. I will miss them.
This is Joe from Brooklyn. I just want to tell Obama, you tried really hard to do what you had to do, but you're leaving a country that's divided down the line. You're leaving a lot of tension. And I think a lot of times you didn't really think about everybody, but only what seemed to make you important.
You can call us with your goodbye to the president at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway using the hashtag Farewell44. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.